Chapter 81. The Struggle in France. The bells are ringing throughout Paris. Behold, there approaches a large procession. Several Roman Catholic clergymen walk in the front, besides various government officials and other prominent citizens of the city walk along. Among those that have joined themselves to the procession, we also notice the King of France, with three of his sons. Such a Roman Catholic parade is called a procession. The king with his three sons walk bareheaded, while each of them holds a wax candle in his hand. Solemnly and stately, the procession proceeds through the main streets of Paris. Now and then they come to a small open square, and upon those open squares, terrible, there they have erected a stake. Above that stake, on a strappado, hangs a person. However, here they have not put the noose around the neck so that after a brief death struggle the victim chokes. No, with this man the rope has been wrapped around his waist so that he cannot choke. As the procession walks slowly past the square, the stake is ignited. The living martyr hangs above it. Through the heat of the fire, his clothes and hair are scorched. However, from time to time, the martyr is drawn up out of the flames and smoke. The clothes, which have already caught fire, are not entirely consumed by the fire because the flames go out. A moment later, they again let the victim sink down into the fire to be soon taken up again. Thus it continues, constantly up and down. For that reason, they have called that instrument of torture strappado, literally to pull. When finally the martyr is half roasted, the hangman at last cuts the rope by which the body falls into the midst of the flames and is soon entirely consumed. I would rather not have described this scene so minutely, but in this case it had to be done, otherwise you would not know how it took place. Well then, during the march of that procession through Paris, at least six of such stakes were ignited, above which six martyrs were slowly burnt to death. This had to intensify that procession. Who were they that were so horribly tortured? Oh, they were but six Protestants, according to Rome, cursed heretics, who were burnt there. And the king approved of that, yea, he had even given command to do so. The name of that king was Francis I. From this sad narrative, it is evident to us that the persecution also raged in France, and thus it was, too. Francis I, the most Christian king of France, ascended the throne in 1515. He was the great opponent and enemy of Charles V, the emperor of Germany. He would have liked to have been emperor of Germany himself, but that wish of his was not fulfilled, because the 19-year-old Charles was chosen. Francis I waged war with Germany almost his entire life. He was a wicked, reckless king who lived a sinful life. The Reformation penetrated also into France, and the writings of Luther were eagerly read. But those Lutheran schismatics were persecuted by him because Francis desired a strong Roman Catholic Church in his realm, and he tried to prevent all that discord in the ecclesiastical sphere. He was not successful in that because the Reformation penetrated irresistibly into France, and also here it became evident that the blood of the martyrs was the seed of the church. Yet Francis I did not hate the Protestants, but because he considered it necessary for France, he nevertheless permitted them to be persecuted with fire and sword. In Germany, he supported the Protestants in their struggle against Charles V, but he did this because the German emperor was his mortal enemy. Division and confusion were permitted to prevail in Germany, the more the better, because thereby that country would be weakened. But in France, rest and peace must prevail, because through that France would become strong and powerful. For that reason, Francis did not tolerate the Protestants in France. We have already told you how Calvin also had to flee from Paris, because they were looking for his life. Disguised as a wine grower, Calvin had escaped from Paris, had he not? That event is not yet forgotten, is it? The persecution raged during the entire reign of Francis I, at one time less, then more violent again. We shall mention yet one more instance. In 1546, 14 stakes had been erected in a circle upon a square in Paris. 14 Protestants were burnt upon them at that same time. According to some writers, these pitiful ones had their tongues cut out of their mouths, but they still praised God, while comforting each other in their pain, and thus they entered into eternal glory. The French king could not destroy that work of God. He could kill the body, but the soul ascended up to God. In spite of the many martyrs and the oppression, God's church in France grew, the same as Israel at one time in Egypt. Do you know who else were horribly persecuted during the reign of Francis I? The Waldenses, who still lived in the Western Alps. In spite of everything, there they had been able to maintain themselves. We still know who they were, do we not? We have told you about the Waldenses in chapter 53. Just read that chapter over again. In the days of Francis I, there still lived about 10,000 Waldenses in the Western Alps. They harmed no one. They had established a few prosperous cities and numerous villages and lived in rest and peace. But those Waldenses were a thorn in the eyes of Rome. Francis I was instigated by his confessor, and the persecution burst loose upon them in full intensity. More than 4,000 Waldenses were murdered. More than 600 were sent to the French galleys, where they died a miserable death. Those galleys, how much misery has been suffered there. They were warships which were moved forward by rowing. Then they were no longer dependent upon the wind. The rowers were prisoners, criminals. But during the persecutions also very many Protestants and Waldenses. They were riveted fast with iron chains to the rowing benches. They lived upon those benches. They slept upon those benches in the most inconvenient posture. During the winter, they were harassed by the severe cold because the frigid wind had free play through the openings on both sides through which the long oars protruded. Unprotected and insufficiently clothed, they sat there, at times drenched with perspiration because of the heavy work, then again numbed by the cold. In the summer they stayed there in the killing heat. There was no pity, no compassion for them, They were defenseless, delivered over to the cruel overseers, who, being armed with long whips, unmercifully lashed the naked back of the poor galley slaves, when, according to the idea of their masters, they did not row hard enough. Sickness and weakness were not considered. They had to row. At times, while trembling with fever, they had to handle those heavy oars. There they remained until death delivered them of their sufferings. There were no doctors for them. Everyone can understand that the death rate was very high among the galley slaves. When a galley slave died, then the chains were made loose, and the corpse was cast overboard. Another would take his place. France had still plenty of them, and need not be sparing. Only the strong ones sometimes held out for several years. Others succumbed in a very short time. If, during a battle, a galley was damaged so much that it would sink, then the sailors and soldiers would try to save themselves. But no one paid attention to the chained galley slaves. No one troubled himself about the lot of those wretched ones. If the ship disappeared into the depth, then all those galley slaves perished miserably. They cried from fear until their voices were smothered by the rushing in water. Well then, as we wrote already, during the persecution under King Francis I, more than 600 Waldenses were sent to those galleys. Therefore, it is no wonder that many tried to save themselves by flight. More than 4,000 Waldenses traveled over the inhospitable Alps and fled to Switzerland. Due to cold and misery, many perished on that journey. The cruel persecutors took a devilish delight in driving the poor fugitives, bereft of everything, ever higher into the Alps. One day the judge of heaven and earth shall avenge all that innocent blood. It shall be demanded at the hand of Rome, who was the instigator of that. Only smoking heaps of rubble were left of those flourishing, prosperous villages of the Waldenses. What a destruction! And why? Because they wanted to serve God according to his word, and were not in agreement with the terrible errors of the Roman Catholic Church. That was their only crime. In 1547, Francis I ended his sinful life and was summoned before God's throne. What an awakening that has been for that king! Dreadful, and that forever. However, with the death of Francis I, the French Protestants received no rest. On the contrary, the persecutions became more intense. The new king, Henry II, was a bitter enemy of Protestantism. And yet, in spite of all this, the Church of the Lord in France continued to grow. However, in those years, Calvinism penetrated more and more into France. The influence of Calvin was great. He wrote letters to various prominent persons. The writings of Calvin were printed and distributed by the thousands. Calvin himself has also been personally in France a few times. At that time, thus during the reign of Henry II, the French Protestants obtained the name of Huguenots, and thus from now on we will also call them that. However, the Lord directed it so that various powerful and prominent persons in France chose the side of the Huguenots. We shall mention a few of them. Two cousins of the king joined themselves to the Huguenots, namely the Prince of Kanda and Anthony of Bourbon. In addition, Dandelot, the commander-in-chief of the army, and not to forget Gaspard de Coligny. Gaspard de Coligny was admiral of France. During the war, he had been made prisoner and had spent 2 years in a dungeon at Sluis. The Lord had converted de Coligny in that prison, and when he became free again, he immediately chose the side of the Huguenots. Through this, a powerful party of the Huguenots came into existence in France. But the Roman Catholic Party was powerful too. The royal court supported the Roman Catholic Party. Moreover, there were two very influential courtiers who were on the side of the Roman Catholics. They were two dukes. The name of the one duke was Francis de Guy, and he was a capable commander. The name of the other duke was Charles de Guy, and he even filled the office of cardinal. It is true, the persecution raged, but yet the king had to be careful, because he had to reckon with the Huguenots. For that reason, he made a pact in 1559 with Philip II, the notorious and dreaded King of Spain. The object was extermination of the heretics. Then the Spanish troops could assist the French king in case the Huguenots took up arms, and that was not a small possibility, especially since the Huguenots, as we have already told you, had obtained powerful protectors. It is known from the Dutch history that just at that time, Prince William of Orange sojourned as a hostage in France. On that occasion, Henry II told everything about that to the prince, but he kept silent about it. Later, we shall hear more about that. And yet, while the Roman Catholic Party proposed to destroy the Huguenots, and it seemed as if the devil would obtain the victory, a large synod was being held by the Huguenots in Paris. We know already that a synod is an ecclesiastical assembly. It was perilous, and yet many preachers and elders had come together at Paris to discuss with each other the interests of the Church of the Lord. At that synod, a confession of faith was drawn up. At that time, the administration of the church was also discussed. The one congregation was not allowed to lord it over another congregation. Each congregation, whether great or small, was independent. If difficulties arose, then they would be discussed at a provincial synod, and from time to time a general synod would meet where office bearers from the entire country would come together. We have about the same regulation in America. What a great difference from the Roman Catholic Church, where the Pope rules, where the hierarchy regulates everything and the Roman Catholic Church dictates the rules. The Lutheran Church did not have this arrangement of the church either, because in the Lutheran churches the separate congregations were not independent, but the state, that is to say, the rulers in Germany, the electors, prescribed the laws to the congregations, and thus they had to obey them. Thus, there we found the state church. As we already told you formerly, a state church is not good. Church and state must stand next to each other, but not above each other. They must support and help each other, it is true, but they must not rule over each other. Thus, now we know the difference in the administration of the Roman Catholic, the Lutheran, and the Calvinistic churches. Although this was a difficult piece, yet we had to say something about it, so that from this it is obvious that the Huguenots were Calvinistic just as we are. Indeed, courage was really necessary to still come together during the most severe persecutions, and that in Paris to discuss those things with each other. Yet those matters were of the greatest importance, for you must know that at that time there were already about 2,000 Calvinistic congregations in France, so that the governing and managing of those congregations was a matter of the greatest importance. For that reason, they braved even the greatest dangers. In the meantime, Henry II made everything ready to destroy the Huguenots with one blow. And then, the French king dies suddenly. At a tournament, a feast for knights, where the so-called contest of unseating one on horseback was held, Henry II was mortally wounded. He could no longer do any harm. God spoke, hitherto and no further. Now nothing became of his horrible murder plans, which he had so carefully prepared. The Lord showed that he too was still here. A quiet Sunday morning, in the little town of Vassy, situated to the east of Paris, the Huguenots have assembled in a barn. Men, women, and children are listening attentively to the minister, who explains a portion out of God's word to them. Nothing disturbs the pleasant quietude. At that moment, a detachment of horsemen approaches that village with a fast trot. An armored knight rides in front. He is the commander of the group. His name is the powerful Duke Francis de Guy, already mentioned before, who has a mortal hatred against the Huguenots. There they ride into the peaceful village. A gruff expression appears upon the face of the stern commander when he notices that the Huguenots are having a divine service in a barn. We do not know how he became aware of it. Have the Huguenots just sang a psalm so that their singing has been heard by the passing horsemen? Has someone from the town told him, perhaps a Roman Catholic citizen who played the role of betrayer? We cannot tell. Suddenly, a short command is heard. The group of horsemen, which is on the way to Paris, turns toward the barn where the Huguenots, who suspect no evil, are gathered. And then that divine service is cruelly disturbed. The heavily armed soldiers fall upon the defenseless Huguenots. Loud cries of distress rend the stillness. Men and women, but also innocent children, are struck down by the cruel soldiers. Their swords drip with blood. In a short time, 60 Huguenots are lying dead or wounded upon the ground, while a much larger number is wounded. Shortly after, the cavalcade continues its way to Paris as if nothing had happened. The commander grins falsely. Those heretics must be exterminated. No pardon for that people. There is no room for them here upon earth. But in Vassy itself, weeping mothers bend themselves while wringing their hands over the corpses of their cruelly murdered children, or men as pale as death stand by the mutilated bodies of their beloved wives. Mourning and sorrow prevail that day, and still long thereafter in Vassy. This shameful act is recorded in history as the Massacre of Vassy. This happened on Sunday, March 10, 1562. This massacre took place just at a time when it seemed as if the Huguenots would obtain a little more rest. They were permitted, at least outside of the large cities, to observe their divine services. It was agreed upon that there the Huguenots were not allowed to be molested. It seemed as if the persecutions would stop. And now suddenly this took place. In those days a king ruled over France of 12 years of age, hence still a child. His name was Charles the Ninth. As a matter of course, that boy could not rule as yet. For that reason, his mother, meanwhile, ruled for him. She was a regent. The name of that mother was Catherine de Medici. She was the widow of Henry II, who had made the pact with Philip II of Spain to exterminate with one blow all the heretics in France and in the Netherlands. She was born in the Italian city of Florence. For a long time already, the royal house of de Medici ruled there. The rulers of that family were exceptionally wicked. We told you about that in the chapter which dealt with Savonarola. Do you still remember that? Since Catherine became an orphan when very young, she was brought up in a convent. And now, through her marriage with Henry II, she had become Queen of France. She has been one of the most crafty and wicked queens that ever lived. That which Jezebel had been for Israel, and Athaliah for Judah, Catherine de Medici was for France. After the sudden death of her husband, first, her son Francis II became king. He was virtually also only a child when he is coronated as king because he was only 15 years old. Yet at that age, that boy was married already. That happened more often in those days. At times, much younger children were given in marriage by their parents. As a matter of course, these were no marriages of love, but they were made for ulterior motives. Well then, the name of the wife of Francis II was Mary Stuart. She was Queen of Scotland, and we hope to tell much more about her later. Francis II was king for only 1 year. Catherine de Medici was regent over him. During that 1 year, the Huguenots were terribly persecuted because Catherine was an ardent Roman Catholic. Francis II died suddenly. No one had counted on that. Still such a young boy. For Catherine de Medici, it was a sad disappointment because all her plans to join both those royal houses and thus also both those countries, France and Scotland, with each other, were dashed to pieces. Also, here we see again that man proposes, but God disposes. Due to the unexpected death of Francis II, such a terrible confusion prevailed in the royal palace that they forgot entirely to bury the king. No one was aware of that corpse, which was lying in state in another room. To the great horror of the royal family, it was only later that they discovered the uninterred corpse of the young king. Then, in order that no one would notice it, some courtiers have in all quietness buried the king at night. His young wife, Mary Stuart, returned to Scotland again. However, bear this in mind, because later we shall come back to this again. In the place of Francis II, the second son of Catherine de Medici, Charles the Ninth, became king. At that time, he was a boy of only 10 years old. 2 years later, in 1562, the Huguenots in the village of Vassy were murdered by Francis de Guy, about which we told you in the beginning of this portion. That massacre of Vassy was soon known throughout entire France. The Roman Catholic Party rejoiced. That was fine. Those cursed heretics must be exterminated. They were treated far too easy. The Huguenots were greatly indignant. That was a shameful breach of promise. Only recently they had been granted the liberty to come together to observe their divine services, except in the large cities. And now this? No, that went too far. They could no longer tolerate that. The Huguenots took up arms everywhere, and a bloody civil war broke out in France. The Huguenots against the Roman Catholic Party. That war was carried on with unprecedented cruelty and bitterness. Streams of blood were shed. At one time, the Huguenots gained the victory, and then again, the Roman Catholic Party was on the winning side. It is impossible to tell you everything about that Huguenot war. Prominent leaders of the Huguenots died or were murdered. But prominent leaders of the Roman Catholics also died. How much misery and harm was suffered everywhere. Great destructions were caused everywhere. The harvest in the field was trampled down and destroyed. The cattle were stolen. 1 year after another went by, and the war continued to rage. Eventually, the most important leaders of the Huguenots were Gaspard de Coligny and a certain Henry of Navarre. Of those two, de Coligny, the Admiral of France, was the most important. He was the central figure of the resistance. The Roman Catholics hated that nobleman. Oh, if they could only kill him. In 1569, his picture was nailed to the gallows. Besides, a reward was set upon his head by the Roman Catholic Party. Whosoever should kill de Coligny would receive a reward of 90,000 francs. Thus, the murderer would become rich at once. Rome has done everything to get hold of de Coligny. And then, suddenly, which no one had anticipated, peace was made between the Huguenots and the Roman Catholics. That was the Peace of Saint Germain in 1570. Unexpectedly, an end had come to the bloodshed. The Huguenots were permitted to assemble freely, only not in Paris or a few of the other large cities. De Coligny was invited by Catherine de Medici to come to the palace. The King Charles IX and de Coligny became the greatest of friends. What a change! 1 year, a reward of 90,000 francs was placed upon the head of de Coligny. And now, a few months later, he was a great friend of the king. It is almost unbelievable. The Huguenots were happy. Their struggle had not been in vain. At last, rest after all. Finally, peace. How blessed